Good morning and welcome to Radio Rehab with Lisa Scythe, who is a professional private counselor with Integrity Psychological and Counseling Associates and an adjunct professor with the Social Work Department at USI. Radio Rehab is only a support to the real work of recovery and does not offer definitive answers or attempt to counsel anyone in their own personal behavior. Although the program does not endorse any program of recovery, it holds the belief that most recovery works are an effort of true conviction and concern of the benefit of the suffering and can be trusted to offer real hope and better choices. And now Radio Rehab with Lisa Scythe.
I want to get to what we're here for today, and that's to hear somebody share their experience, strength, and hope about their life and what affected him and what shaped him and how he finally got into recovery. And as you all know and have written and called so many times, a lot of people can get sober and get clean, but how do they stay sober and how do they stay clean? Rusty's very fired up about sobriety and loves his program and the people that he knows that he shares his recovery with, so I know his story will be compelling. It's his experience, strength, and hope. Don't hesitate to call 424-1400 if you have any questions. We want to be sure and answer those for you. But I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Rusty to start sharing his story. We'll take a few breaks, but again, don't hesitate to call if you have any questions or comments. Rusty, you are always ready, willing to do whatever to carry the message. Thanks so much for coming. I mean, I just called you a couple days ago, and you said, yep, I'll be there. Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. My name is Rusty. I'm a recovering alcoholic, also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober since December of 2006, and it's always a pleasure to give away what was freely given to me, that people were there to tell me the message that there is a better way. And so in return, I have to give that back, is what I was told. So I try to do that to the best of my ability. I appreciate you asking me to be here. A little nervous, but that's okay.
It's the microphone.
I'm not usually on the radio, but I'll just say this. My story is no reflection as the membership of AA as a whole, that I'm just one among many, and there are as many different faces. There are different stories and different ways we get here, and that we don't always have to go as low as some others have went into the depths of alcoholism and addiction, rather than like we can get better when we choose and when we've had enough of, you know, living the way we live when we're out there drinking. So I just like to say that if there's someone out there and they can't relate to my story, that there is someone they can relate with, and that I spent a lot of time thinking I was the only one who felt the way I was feeling. And just like to say that, you know, there's plenty of people out there that you can talk to and relate with, and that you're not on your own. I guess I'll just start with my story. I grew up in Western Kentucky, and I'm the youngest of five. Four out of five of us have been to jail. You know, I'll just say that. And my oldest brother, he's pretty normal, but the rest of us kind of, you know, did our own thing and kind of acted silly. I'm the youngest of five, and my parents were always there for me growing up. I had, you know, they taught me how to act, and, you know, I was a pretty good kid, really, and I was pretty wild, though. You know, we lived out in the country, and I kind of got to do what I wanted. Back, you know, I'm 27, so it's not that long ago that I was a kid, but no one was really worried about getting kidnapped then. My mom would always say, well, they'll bring you back if they do take you. So, yeah, that's kind of the way it was. You know, my neighbor, we knew the neighbors. We just, they let me out in the mornings, and I'd go run around, you know, and have fun. And so I had a friend whose father would get us alcohol, you know, and, you know, I took my first drink. I think I was about 11. And I blacked out that night. You know, we drank a little too much for some 11-year-olds. And I blacked out, and my friend got alcohol poisoning and nearly died. And that was my first drink of alcohol. And I never really said that I wouldn't ever do it again, though. I remember waking up feeling pretty rough. But I also remember the feeling that when I drank that alcohol for the first time, I never knew I felt incomplete until that alcohol kind of completed me, that I felt whole and at one with the world. You know, I felt pretty good. I never really felt bad about myself up to that point. I was never, you know, real insecure or anything, but that alcohol really made me feel a lot better. And I didn't start drinking from then on. It was more like every now and then we might get a chance to drink a little bit on a weekend, and we'd do that. But if we couldn't, that was okay too. But my parents were always there for me. I played sports and stuff up till about middle school. When my dad died, I was about 9 years old. He died of cancer. And I remember thinking, you know, that nobody was there for me to go to the baseball games anymore. So it was kind of a reason to start slacking off. And about that age, around middle school, I guess, is when people were starting to get more athletic. You know, kids were really practicing and playing hard in sports. And that wasn't one of my specialties, was practice. You know, I would play the game, but if it came to working out and running outside of practice, I really wasn't big on that. And turns out once you get that age, you have to practice to be good. So that started some self-esteem issues, I would say, that I didn't feel as good about myself when I was around people who were better than me at something. And it wasn't the thinking at the time, but looking back, if I couldn't be the best at it, then I didn't even want to play anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. And I would, you know, and that came into my school life, too. When I was in school, that, you know, I wasn't the smartest kid. I could have made A's if I wanted to, but I definitely wasn't the smartest kid, and because I didn't try. And I figured if I can't be the smartest, you know, I'm going to act out in class and kind of get negative attention if I can't get positive attention. And because it was always about getting some kind of attention, really. I wanted somebody to look at me and laugh at my jokes and stuff like that. And so I would act out accordingly to that, you know, whatever got me some attention. And definitely the way I was raised and the people I was around had nothing to do with me being alcoholic, you know, or a drug addict or anything. That it was really my reaction to the drugs or the alcohol when I put them into my system is what makes me an alcoholic. That I mean, I believe I have the gene for alcoholism. That the first time I drank, my body had been missing that alcohol, and it, you know, a physical craving had set off, and you know, a few shots turned into the rest of the bottle pretty quick for me, you know. But anyway, through school, I tried hard enough to get by. That was kind of my deal, is that I wouldn't do more than I had to, because I didn't want to look like I was trying in case anybody was looking. Because if I failed, then they could say, well, you were trying and you failed. What a loser type of deal. So I just wouldn't try. You know, I'd do just enough to get by. And that's, you know, it's the easier way, the easiest way I could find, because I didn't want to look silly. So I graduated high school, and it was kind of funny. At my high school graduation, all the people I went to school with were, you know, kind of like, what are you doing here? because, you know, they knew me as more the class clown rather than the guy studying and trying to pass the test. But it also shows that, you know, once I put my mind to something, I could accomplish it, you know, if I really wanted to. And but I graduated, and I'd already been on probation up to this point. I got in trouble for some marijuana at school, and I got kicked out, and I went to night school, and somehow they thought going to school at 3 p.m. was punishment. It really, to me, it was a delight. You know, that's when I was really wanting to wake up anyway, around 2 in the afternoon. But I get kicked out of school and started getting in trouble, I guess. I was, my friends, I'd kind of chose the people who drank and smoked pot and stuff like that, that, you know, because that's what I was interested in doing. And I found people who made me feel a little bit better about what I was doing, people that drank like I did, who liked to drink anytime they got a chance, rather than, you know, some of them, I was friends with the athletes and all these other kids in school. I got along with everybody, But when I hung around those people, I kind of felt bad about the way I was living because they didn't drink. They didn't smoke cigarettes. You know, they would actually study when they got home from school and not look for a bag of pot, you know, and that's what I did. So I kind of cut those people out of my life because, you know, I felt bad when I was around them. I didn't, you know, self-esteem issues and pride and ego that I wanted to hang around people living the way I lived and doing what I did. So, but anyway, I was sent to my first AA meeting. I think I was 15 or 16, and I was not interested. I thought there was no way that, you know, a 16-year-old could be an alcoholic because I had this picture painted, and it's almost like that on, you know, with TV that I had to be a wino living under a bridge, drinking all the time. And that's not the way it was. I drank when I could, but that didn't make me any less of an alcoholic because it turns out the only thing that makes me alcoholic is the effect that alcohol has on me, that it's almost a spiritual effect when I drink, that I feel, you know, okay with everything around me and, you know, I use it to deal with situations when, you know, pressure, celebration, you know, good things, bad things, whatever, that I had to use alcohol to go through that. You know, I remember graduation night, I had to get loaded because I couldn't be around all those people sober. You know, I really thought sober Rusty was kind of boring. So, you know, when I would get drunk and lively, you know, and I'd usually get a little too lively and, you know, getting act silly that night and wake up the next day feeling pretty bad about what I did. You know, just nothing serious, just get drunk and fall down type of stuff. And, you know, that not everybody else was doing that. So, that, you know, there's some self-esteem stuff going on that my friends didn't act like that all the time. So I kind of started seeing that maybe there's a problem with the way I drink early on. I mean, probably at the age 16, I knew there was something wrong. So I just didn't think it was alcoholism. I thought that maybe if I could, it was the people I was around, you know, if I just didn't hang around these guys, I wouldn't act like this. Or if I, you know, if you lived in this small town, there's nothing else to do, you'd act like this too, you know.
Justifying it.
Yeah, I would, you know, if your dad had died at an early age, you know, I'd say stuff like that to myself, like, what do you expect, you know? And that had nothing to do with the way I was behaving. You know, my mother did the best she could with me, and I just really didn't listen, you know. Her advice was good advice, you know. She just didn't have anybody willing to take it. And I, you know, 18 years old, I moved out, and that was short-lived. By the time I was 20, I was back in with my mom, and felt pretty silly about that. I started out, I like to say, really, I started out on bottom when I started drinking because I had nothing of my own. You know, I could get a job that didn't drug test and didn't pay so well either, but I, you know, that's what I could do. And eventually that, you know, there's guilt leading up to that. It's like, well, if I would have went to college, I wouldn't be, you know, in this hole or whatever. But anyway, I think I kind of started out on bottom, and that, that's why I kind of got sober as soon as I did, is because I didn't really have anything to lose, you know, other than my self-respect. And I lost that pretty quick because I was a blackout drinker and I would act kind of silly when I drank. And I remember thinking that if I could just catch a break, if somebody would just, you know, throw me a bone, I guess you could say, that, you know, I was always looking for something on the outside to fix me on the inside. You know, if I could just get a good job, something that paid well, I could save up some money and, you know, feel a little better about myself. And I never really did anything to feel good about myself because, you know, I would drink and I would, not always, but sometimes I would black out and act silly. And the next day I would say, I'm not drinking anymore. This is after high school. I'd say, I'm done drinking. I can't keep on living like this. It's embarrassing, you know. And I would say, I'm done. And about a week later, maybe 2 days, maybe 2 weeks, I would start thinking, well, maybe a beer or two would be fine. You know, I'll just go drink a few beers. And, you know, and that was always the plan. And then I would start drinking a little whiskey, or I'd, you know, throw some drugs in there too. You know, I did drugs too. But once that alcohol entered my body, I had no control over what happened next. Most times it was like a flip of the coin of what was going to happen. You know, I wasn't real sure, but I was, you know, willing to take that risk because that alcohol made me feel good about myself. So I would drink and, you know, just lose control. And that's why I believe I'm powerless over alcohol, because when I drink, I can't always control how much I take. And even when I'm sober for a period, I can't always choose when I start drinking either. That I would tell myself, you know, the probation officer would say, you have to stay sober or I'm putting you in jail, you know. And I say, okay. And, you know, 3 weeks later, I'm saying, well, she didn't mean I can't drink beer, you know. And that was that alcoholic mind working on me, saying, you know, you could do it if you just do it this way. And I would drink again, and the same stuff always happened. And I ended up in jail for the last time. And I look, I don't know, it's a God thing, I guess. I took a good look around me of the people, the company I was keeping in jail. And these people had been doing this their whole life. You know, here I am 21 years old, and these guys are 40 and 50. And it's kind of like, if I wanted what they had, I could just keep doing what I was doing, you know, and I would get the life they had, sitting in jail for whatever. And I, you know, took a good long look and said, I don't really want to live like this anymore, that I want some things in my life. You know, I want, you know, material stuff. First off would be nice. I lost my license when I was 17 for a DUI. And, you know, that's not normal, you know, but I could rationalize it and say, you know, whatever reason, that if I, if you had the same background I did, you'd drink too, type of deal, you know. So at 17, I lost my license, and there's a whole new load of guilt right there, you know. Just that's when I really, my drinking kind of became a way to escape from the way I felt, rather than a social thing, you know, just having fun at the party. That I would kind of drink because I didn't like who I was sober, you know, didn't really feel good about myself.
Right.
And rightfully so, I shouldn't have felt good about myself.
Right.
You know, so the way I was living, no one should feel good about themselves like that. And I didn't. So, and I also think that's a God doing for me what I can't do for myself, giving me a conscience like that, saying, Rusty, there's a better way. You just have to, you know, give up your way and, you know, know that you can't do it on your own. So,
wow. Wow, what a story. Don't go away, Radio Rehab. We have to take a break and hear from our sponsors. We're talking to Rusty, who's showing us and sharing with us the progression of this disease, actually from 11 years old till the time he stopped. So we'll be right back. invite you to give one at the Warm Center in Henderson.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess we're back. I was just telling Rusty he needs to give a lead more often. So we were talking about how at 20 you move back into your house and you knew you were at the bottom. You pretty much started at the bottom. So where, when you're at the bottom, you know you're at the bottom. You're waiting for somebody to throw you a bone.
Well, my grandfather was a minister, and he was a great example of God in my life. Ever since I was a small child, I remember he lived what's in the Bible. You know, he wasn't Baptist who would preach on Sunday and drink on Monday type of deal. He never drank or smoked his whole life, and he lived the Word of God, and I respected him for that. But I didn't always agree with what he had to say, you know, because I thought God was someone who was after me. You know, I thought that God never gave me what I wanted, you know, and thought that he was unfair, and thought that if, you know, I'm sure we've all heard this before, but it was almost like a Santa Claus type God. You know, when I'm putting stipulations on God, then I'm in the wrong seat, you know, saying, God, if you give me this, then I'll be happy. And it turns out, really, in reality, I don't know what I need to be happy, but God does. But anyway, my grandfather, he was an example that there was a better way to live, you know. And I remember when I was 16 and so, he would tell me, not so much in detail, but he knew I had something going on. And, you know, I got sent to church camp when I was young, and that didn't really work out. I had to leave early because my dad's dad died while I was there. So that's just another thing, you know. It's kind of like, if this is what God does for me, you know, I don't want any part of it, you know. But anyway, I knew church had an answer, and I knew that there was a better way, because there had to be. You know, the way I was living, it wasn't going to last too long. You know, I was either going to end up in jail, you know, and people like me, we spend a lot of time in jail, you know. But anyway, I was either going to end up in jail, treatment, suicide, you know, drunk driving accident, something. This stuff happens all the time. Of course, I didn't think it happened to me. But anyway, I started going to church, and just really looking for a way out, you know. And the church people, I actually have a Bible at home. They all signed for me, and they said, if you ever need anything, you can call us. And but I just couldn't relate with them, you know. My problems were totally different than theirs. You know, I was in the grips of alcoholism and addiction, and they were you know, struggling with, like, not looking at the secretary at work or whatever, you know, like that type of sin. And I'm here, I am, like, I can't keep my hand out of somebody else's wallet. You know, I can't keep my mind where it needs to be. I was always struggling with, you know, not drinking and not, you know, I was a criminal, you know, because I had to fund it somehow. And, but anyway, I would, just set myself apart from the group and saying they can't really help me, you know. And and that was those were the thoughts in my head that you know, there's a way. And then the, you know, like the other thought was, but this isn't it, they can't help you. And I tried, I got baptized, and you know, didn't go too far. And you know, as far as maybe Bible studies or anything like that, but I was going to church and looking for more positive people to be around. And I remember I got baptized, and you know, there's this firm resolution that I'm going to stay sober, and I'm going to, you know, get a good job, because there's people in the church that can hook me up with a good job, and I'm going to date this guy's daughter, and everything's going to be fine, you know, find some rich man's daughter, and, you know, everything's going to be all right, because I think it's all material stuff that I need. Mm-hmm. And, well, I got baptized, I went home and ate a handful of pills, and I say a handful, maybe just a few, enough to catch a buzz, and all I had, probably. And I remember I cried, and I thought that, you know, this is bottom. You know, this is pathetic. I just told myself 30 minutes ago that I'm done. You know, I'm not drinking again. I'm not doing any drugs. I've got to find a better way to live. And that just shows that I was powerless, that I couldn't choose, you know. And if I think that this alcoholism and addiction is a matter of willpower, you know, it obviously wasn't, you know, because I've heard so many stories since then similar to mine that no matter how great the necessity for staying sober, it just, I couldn't do it on my own willpower. You know, I could do it for a little while. In high school, I stayed sober long enough to get off probation, you know, and did that. And I was happy when I did that, too. Actually, my grades went up and all that. But once I was off the probation, you know, I went back to doing what I was doing. But anyway, the willpower just wouldn't cut it, you know, so I really thought something was wrong with me, that I thought if this is what life was going to be like, you know, I might as well end it and that or just keep on doing what I was doing until it took me. Because one thing that really got me into going to church was my friend came in from the Army and he died of an overdose. Like, we partied that night and he went home and he didn't wake up the next day. And, you know, I carried a lot of guilt around for that, you know, thinking I had something to do with that. But I didn't, you know, I was just there and I was just, and that's what happens to us. We take a little too much one night and, you know, tomorrow's never a promise for people like me, that it's just a gamble, you know, and it was a gamble I took many times. That I would take pills. Sometimes I didn't even know what they were, you know, but this guy said they'd give you a buzz. So heck, I'll give you $2 a piece for them, you know, and it's just what I was willing to do to, get out of myself and quit feeling the way I felt. You know, after my friend died, that was really it for me. I was done, you know, I was done forever. And I remember one night I got down on my knees, the first real prayer I ever prayed, you know, I said, God, please help me. And of course I had to make sure no one was looking, you know, that my whole family was watching me kill myself one day at a time. But I couldn't let them see me pray, you know. They'd see me hung over and, you know, just pathetically acting silly the night before. But God forbid they see me say a prayer, you know. And that's where I was at with humility. I had none. And I prayed that prayer. I said, God, please help me. And I was expecting, you know, like a better job or some kind of opportunity. You know, that's just what my mind thought with success was money or a better looking partner, you know. And so none of that came. Actually, I got arrested again. And, you know, I'm thinking God asked for help, you know, not another problem, you know. So anyway, I got arrested. And it was, I don't know, it was a God thing for sure, the way it all played out, you know. But I won't go into that. But the judge that I went to see had seen me when I was 16, you know, and I remember she told me that I have a drug and alcohol problem and that sobriety is really my only option. And she told me that when I was young, and I kind of shook it off, like, she doesn't, you know, she doesn't really know who I am. That really doesn't apply to me. But anyway, I seen that same judge again, and she was still singing the same song, sobriety, that's what you need, you know, 12 steps. A 12-step program, you need to do this and that. And, well, she told me that again, and she let me out of the handcuffs, and I got put into drug court, and I stayed sober for a little while in drug court, I believe 90 days. And I wasn't involved in a 12-step program. I went to meetings, but that's all I did. You know, I griped and moaned about them on the way to and from, you know. Say, this stuff really isn't going to work for me. You know, I'm not an alcoholic, first off, was my first thought, you know. And I didn't really know what alcoholism was. And until someone really properly educated me on what alcoholism was, I was going to suffer from it. And but once I became alcoholic, decided, you know what, maybe I'm an alcoholic, and started into the solution, which for me is the 12 steps. And going to AA meetings and prayer and meditation and trying to help others. Once I started that, things seemed to have gotten better. But up to that point, I didn't think it would work for me. And I stayed sober 90 days just on, you know, the fear of going to jail again. And, you know, the night came when I needed a drink, and I drank again, and I took, I think, 4 shots of whiskey, and that's all it took. I knew I had to go take a drug test on Monday. This is on a Friday night. I knew I had to take a test. I mean, they tested me 5 days a week. But, you know, once that alcohol hit my system, that you know, I was going to out-slick the program of drug court, you know, and I was down at my friend's house getting high on whatever we had, and you know, I stayed stayed out of jail for a little while in drug court. You know, I cheated the test, and I remember the day that a test came back positive. They'd sent off to the lab, and my friend was looking on the paper. They had a paper saying if you passed or failed the test, and we were all used to saying we passed the test, and my buddy looked on the paper and said, "Rusty, you're positive for this, that, and the other," and all I could say is, "Get me out of here," you know? And we took off. He took me home, and I commenced to getting drunk and high that night. And I pretty much knew that it was going to be the last night I could. And the drug court, they let me go till the next Tuesday. You know, they let me kind of run around in my guilt and shame and stuff. And I showed up that next week, and they sent me off, and I was sent to a place in Owensboro called New Horizons. And pretty much it's just a place for guys to get involved in AA and in church too. I met a lot of great people in church, but I've been sober ever since I went there, and that's not because of me or my willpower changed. It's because I got involved in the 12 steps and started doing something different. You know, I quit saying that I'm different and here's how, and started saying, well, maybe I'm alcoholic and what can I do to get better? You know, I was in there with this 70-year-old man, and his greatest goal was to have an apartment by his next birthday. And here I am, I'm 22, and I'm like, this is not the way I want to live. And these guys would say, you don't have to go any further down. You know, if you choose to, that's on you. But if you want to get better, you can get better, and you can live a great life. And that's the message I try to carry, that no matter age, race, or gender, you know, we can get better from alcoholism and addiction when we choose, when we've had enough of trying the same thing over and over, you know, that knowing that my will can't cut it. And when I finally gave in and said, God, what is your will for me? And began to do simple things like being kind to everybody I meet, or at least try to. I was, you know, helping out people in the halfway house, trying to be helpful around there, and just things I was never really used to, like getting out of myself through service. But once I started doing those things, I started to get better, and sobriety wasn't hard like it was when I was in drug court. I mean, it was just in drug court, it was like a daily grind. When it was just me with no recovery, it was just me against the world. And once I started trying to get better, you know, it was more like, what can I do for the world, and what can I get out of daily life, rather than, God, I have to go through this again. Wow. You know, so what I did was what people told me to in AA, and, you know, my sponsor, I got a sponsor, and I remember the first meeting I heard him talk, I could relate with everything he said about the problem, you know, about alcoholism and going down to these levels of addiction and stuff, and I couldn't relate with him when he began talking about the solution, because he was married, he had a good job, he had a wife, family that loved him. I just couldn't relate with that, and I wanted what he had, and I commenced to doing what he told me to do, and I got better. You know, it's not that it works for certain people, it works for everybody if you do the deal. And that's what they told me. They said, if you want what we have, do what we do. And if you want what you have, keep doing what you were doing, and because you'll keep getting it. And, you know, so sobriety in the beginning was about staying out of jail, really. It was, what can I do to stay out of jail? But once I got into the steps, I began to feel the presence of God in my life. You know, I felt it at peace with who I was. And, you know, I was okay with being me for the first time in a long time. You know, I felt comfortable in my own skin, is the way I've heard it a lot. And that's the way I felt. And that's, you know, the way I feel today. You know, when I got into sobriety, this was not the plan to be talking on a radio show,
right,
you know, about recovery. My best thinking was, as soon as I get done with drug court and do this year in the halfway house, I'm going to go back to doing what I was doing. you know, drinking and trying to sell drugs, usually going broke trying that, you know. They say a monkey can't sell bananas, you know, and dope head can't sell dope either. It doesn't work out. But I got involved, and
there was definitely a turning point.
Yeah, pretty much. What did it for me was knowing that my way wasn't getting me anywhere, and I was ready to try something different.
Don't go away, Radio Rehab. We're talking to Rusty and hearing his story of addiction and a lot of recovery. We'll be right back.
We're back to Radio Rehab talking to Rusty, and I think there might be a caller. Is there a caller? Do we have a question or a comment? Okay, well, they'll let us know if we do, Rusty, for sure. So you just talked about the progression of your alcoholism and how the prayers and all the interventions that occurred in your life, but somewhere along the line, that last stop when you surrendered, the willingness hit you. Would you say, for those that are listening and don't understand our program of recovery, but I think most people want to understand that willingness has to somewhere along the line happen there.
Yeah, really it came for me in just surrender of my own will, knowing that my will wouldn't keep me from drinking. And if I did try to do God's will, you know, that I could stay sober and be really happy and feel good. So that's really what the willingness was for me, is just that, you know, say when I didn't feel like getting up and going to a meeting, I got up and went to a meeting, or, you know, tried to be helpful in some way. So
don't go away. I think we do have a caller. Hi, welcome to Radio Rehab.
Well, good morning, Lisa. This is Marvelline.
Marvelline, good morning.
Yes, I was just listening to Rusty. He has a testimony.
Yes.
And Rusty, I want you to take it to the community.
Oh, my God. This is Marlene.
You may save some person from, you know, you said your friend died. Well, there's a purpose for you being here. You know that, don't you?
Yes, I believe so.
And so I think you need to take your message to the community. It is fantastic.
Thank you, Marvelline. That's our co-hostess here, and she's very active in the community, Marvelline. That's a real compliment coming from you, Marvelline, because we hear a lot of people share their stories, but I was telling Rusty the same thing, that he has a nice way of sharing the progression of his disease and his recovery.
Mm-hmm. And he needs to take it to the community because he may save someone, okay?
Thank you, and I'll make sure you get his number.
Okay.
Okay, see you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
But yeah, I would just like to say shortly as a result of staying sober, you know, at one point I would say I was homeless, but mom would just let me live with her. And today I'm a homeowner, I'm married, and have a beautiful wife and, you know, a bright future. And that's, you know, because of my recovery and not because of anything else. Because without sobriety, I don't have anything.
And you know, Rusty, I think Marvelline's right. That is a message people need to hear, because all we see are the jails full or the streets full of dope being dealt. And we need to see that people can get better through God's grace and through AA and NA and willingness.
For sure. Yes.
You know, I think that willingness piece is a key, isn't it, for you?
Yes. I mean, I could take the life I have today and take it for granted and not give back to what was given to me, you know, carrying the message, doing stuff like this and just trying to be helpful. And I could sit at home and enjoy the things that I have from sobriety. And I just thank God that I haven't taken advantage of that, that I consistently, I mean, I go to 4 meetings a week. I sponsor people. I try to be helpful. And, you know, I stay active rather than sitting at home and enjoying the things and going on trips all the time like I would like to. And that's part of the willingness for me is just not, I don't always get to do what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes when it's, you know, rainy and cold outside, I don't want to go to an AA meeting. But that's what we do, and that's how we stay sober, is through, you know, consistent action.
And why do you think the Rustys and the Sams and the Kyles and the Charlies, why do you think you guys are willing to go to that length where so many people aren't?
Well, you know, I don't want to sound like a, you know, I do this thing perfect, because I definitely don't. You know, there are times when I don't really want to get out of myself and be helpful, and sometimes, you know, I give into that, but mm-hmm. for the most part, you know, there's a lot of people in AA who get out and do the deal and help others.
So you think service work
is
a key?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely action, mm-hmm. you know. For me, I have to wake up in the morning and do a short meditation followed by a prayer, you know, somewhat consistently, or I'm not too emotionally stable. You know, that's God keeps me emotionally stable. Mm-hmm. Up to myself, I'm pretty crazy. You know, if I go 3 days without prayer, I'm not the guy you're hearing on the radio. You know, I'm the guy in traffic flipping you off, you know. So that's just how quick I can go from, you know, calmness and serene to my will back. You know, it's just the prayer and meditation going out the window.
So do you think, because you've been clean since 2006, do you think the best relapse prevention for you or for anybody is to keep up that routine and that momentum that you started?
Most definitely. I have to keep doing the things that have worked for the last, you know, going on 6 years. AA meetings, prayer, meditation. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other people, and we work the steps together, and that's our solution. So if I give up on that, I mean, I have no other way. That's my only way to stay sober. If I had another way, I wouldn't have ever been in AA, you know? So it's really what works is what I have to stick with.
Are your family and friends that aren't in AA pretty supportive? Do they understand that this is something you have to make your number one priority?
Yeah, definitely. My mother, when I told her, you know, I'm an alcoholic, I think she said, I know, you know.
Really?
So it wasn't a shock to her. You know, she's seen it coming. And, yeah, so she's definitely supportive. And she, you know, has always been a positive influence in my life, and she still is. She's the strongest woman I know. Mm-hmm. And so that's, yeah, she's the family, you know, somewhat is they have their own problems and stuff, you know. But
and your wife?
My wife is very supportive. You know, it's not a question of, can I go to a meeting? Do you mind? You know, and by all means, I should be there, you know, and she knows that. So that's what we do.
I think that's pretty important, too, that the people that love us understand this has to be
a life priority.
And death thing. Yeah.
Yes, recovery is number one in my life. It has to be, because without that, I don't have anything else.
Right.
You know, I would love to say my wife's the most important thing to me, but I met her when I was sober, and if I'd been drinking, she wouldn't have wanted anything to do with me.
Yeah.
You know, my job, they wouldn't have me if I was drinking. You know, it's just the way it is. So you know, just looking at it on paper, the facts is that I have to be sober to be any way useful. So
in closing, God, I could keep talking to you and listening. In closing, is there anything you think we need to say or impart upon the listeners that might just help turn somebody around or get them into recovery?
Well, I mean, don't sell yourself short, you know, because I was selling myself short by saying, you know, that I'm not an alcoholic and these people can't help me, or I'm not a drug addict, I can quit when I want. You know, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, if you don't think, you know, you can, if you think you can do it on your own, try staying sober for a year. And if you can't, you probably, you know, there's a problem there. You know, that's not exactly what it says. That's like the West Kentucky version, you know.
No, it says go out and try some normal drinking if you want to.
Yeah, that's, give it a shot. You know, there are AA meetings all over the town. There's a central office that you can look probably under Alcoholics Anonymous in the phone book. And there's, you know, give it a shot.
Where could people find you most likely? What meetings?
Well, my home group meets Wednesday night at 7 o'clock on First Avenue in Virginia at the First Presbyterian Church in the basement.
Is that an open meeting?
That is a men's meeting.
Okay.
And there are many meetings around town. So, you know, come check them out.
And if you all want to know how to get a hold of Rusty, you could also call the radio station and I could get with him and get him to you.
Most definitely.
For sure. I'll definitely have to get your number to Marvelline. Look out when your phone number goes to Marvelline. You'll be getting called.
Yeah. Good.
So I think, though, that you do have that pure willingness to carry the message if you're asked.
Yeah, and I don't want to take too much credit for this. You know, this is God doing for me, you know,
right.
And I'm just a try to be a vessel. I try to clear away enough of my garbage that I can be a useful tool for God. And if I think this is about me, then my ego is coming back and I have to watch out. So, you know, it's definitely just how can I be of service, and hopefully I'm willing to do that, you know, that God will work through me. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know some people you've worked with and that have worked with you, and it is just our community. I wish we could take credit, but we're not allowed to, and it wouldn't do us any good to, would it?
Yeah, I don't want the credit.
Right. Just one day at a time.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for inviting me.
And community, again, if you have any questions or comments, you can always call or write us here at WEOA. We appreciate your letters and comments, and we try to answer them whenever we're able to. Rusty, I hope we can have you come back sometime.
For sure.
Bring some of your friends and be a friend of Radio Rehab. We need you.
Sounds good.
Thank you. Radio Rehab, thanks for tuning in. We will be back next week at 10 o'clock, so don't forget between now and then to do the next right thing.